You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you all for joining us today here, as well as by video conference from DC, London, and Brussels. I just want to take 2 quick minutes and introduce you to the Ideas Initiative under which we're having this India series, as well as let you know a little bit about the series itself. As you know, last year we launched this Ideas Initiative to foster reflection and discussion on areas of concern that are under-examined at OSF. And along those lines, we saw a potential to have a wide-ranging conversation about India, a country that has incredible innovations as well as massive dysfunctions. India has become an economic, political, and cultural force that we cannot ignore, since it does or will bear impact on many aspects of our current work. So we see this session and the forthcoming sessions as a way to think better about how we can learn from India, regardless of whether or not OSF sees a space to work within India. We've now organized a few different conversations on related topics, including at the Network Program Directors meeting in Cape Town back in May, as well as the sub-board members meeting in Budapest 2 weeks ago. And so now we see this as a chance to throw open the discussion to the wider network, and we hope to follow up this discussion on governance with future sessions on the nexus between corruption and technology, on India's development, as well as its rights-based social movements. This meeting is being recorded in audio, and its audio and meeting notes will be available on the Carl community. We also encourage you to continue this discussion online, and please let me know if you're not already on the Carl community and you would be, like to be added. And we look at both the Ideas Initiative as well as the session series on India as collaborative efforts, so we very much welcome your thoughts, ideas on future things we can explore around India, as well as future session series entirely. With that, and I should also mention, as an additional point, we are also having a meeting or reception this evening with some of our fellows. So those of you who can join us, we'd very much love to see you tonight as well. With that, let me turn you over to our moderator, Fauzia, who is a vice president at the Soros Economic Development Fund. Her responsibilities include structuring and implementing investment strategies in microfinance, mobile banking, microinsurance, SMEs, affordable housing, and other social sector development initiatives globally. She oversees SEDF's India portfolio and co-manages OSF's Pakistan Economic Policy Initiative. In fact, and this is purely for internal use at this point, the SEDF board just on Friday approved $10 million for its second investment in India. Before joining SEDF, Fauzia worked for 5 years at the Women's World Banking as a microfinance specialist with responsibility for Pakistan and other Asian countries, and for 10 years with Citibank in New York, where she worked for the Financial Institutions Group for Emerging Markets. She has a BA in International Relations from Mount Holyoke College and her master's from SIPA at Columbia. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Fauzia. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Bipasha and Lenny, for asking me to moderate this very important discussion and the first of its kind that we're going to have. It's a real honor. I take the pleasure to introduce our two panelists. To my left is Dr. Sanjay Reddy. Dr. Reddy is an associate professor of economics as well as co-academic director of the India-China Institute at the New School for Social Research, and that's a new development, we understand. Congratulations. His areas of work include development economics, international economics and philosophy. He holds a PhD in economics from Harvard University, an MPhil in social anthropology from the University of Cambridge, and an AB in applied mathematics with physics from Harvard University. Shabby resume you've got there. He has held fellowships and been a visiting scholar at diverse academic institutions in India, Europe, and the US, including the Center for Ethics and the Professions, and the Center for Population and Development Studies at Harvard University, and the Center for Human Values at Princeton University. He has conducted extensive research for development agencies and international institutions, including the G24 Group of Developing Countries, ILO, Oxfam, UNDSA, Department of Economic and Social Affairs, and the UN Secretariat, UNICEF, UNDP, UNU, WIDER, World Institute for Development Economics Research, UNRISD, UN Research Institute for Social Development, and the World Bank. And to my right is Siddharth Depp, who is author of numerous works of fiction and nonfiction, all of which I've read, including most recently The Beautiful and the Damned, A Portrait of the New India, a very interesting book which I encourage all of you to read. His essays, articles, and reviews have appeared in Harper's, in the New York Times Book Review, The Nation, The Guardian, and numerous other publications. Siddharth is an associate professor of creative writing at the New School. Siddharth grew up in Shillong in northeast India. He was educated in India and at Columbia University. He began his career in journalism as a sports journalist in Calcutta in 1994 before moving to Delhi to continue regular journalism until 1998. His first novel, The Point of Return, is semi-autobiographical in nature and is set in a fictional hill station that closely resembles Shillong. His second novel, Surface, also set in northeast India, is about a disillusioned Sikh journalist. In 2004, he worked as an undercover reporter for The Guardian, working at a call center in Delhi at a time when globalization was fast proceeding and Thomas Friedman declared the world flat. That was the final word, the world is flat. His experience interviewing the call center staff led him to undertake his first nonfiction book, which is The Beautiful and the Damned, a darkly comic exploration of 21st century India. So gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. And we will give each of you about 10 to 12 minutes to talk about largely the issue of governance and basically how you see India within that overall context. And I'm being told I'm not speaking the mic. Okay. So Sanjay, may we start with you?
Thank you, Fazia. I think it's something of a poison chalice to be asked to start this discussion because there's so many issues which one could raise and many ways, too many. But before I comment on that, let me thank Lenny and Bipasha, as well as you, Fazia, for this opportunity. I'm very glad to have this occasion. I think there are many, many people you can and should draw on to have a richer discussion, and I certainly don't feel as if I'm the most qualified or even among the more qualified, but I do have my two bits to say, so in that spirit, I'll venture forward. Joan Robinson, the famous and perhaps infamous Cambridge economist, used to say about India that for everything which is true about India, its opposite is also true. That statement has, by the way, since been attributed to various other people in print, but to the best of my knowledge, it was Joan Robinson who said that. I think as much as it was true in the 1950s or 60s when she may have said it, it's also still true. I'm also reminded when I think about the difficulty of the task of having the kind of discussion which you'd like to have here, of a description which Amartya Sen gives in one of his writings, in which he on culture, in which he mentions that at some point when he gave a talk in Switzerland, someone in the audience raised their hand and asked him the question, "Do you like culture?" And before he could fully absorb the stupidity of the question, he found himself answering yes. So it's a little bit like that, asking whether India is relevant for debates on development or debates on governance. Of course it's relevant. And whether it's relevant and in what ways it's relevant is, of course, something which can only be discovered through the details. It can't be answered at a question of generality. Being a friend of OSI, some of you will know my personal connections to the organization. Certainly think it would perhaps enrich the discussion within OSI to draw some Indian examples into that discussion. But that having been said, whether or not OSI should be, and in what ways involved more concretely in India's development debates and governance debates and human rights debates and so on, is I think something that you are best positioned to work out. Our charge today, I think, was to speak in particular on the theme of governance, and that raises, of course, many different aspects, or has many different sides. I'm reminded of, among other things, of the famous book by Selig Harrison, probably most of you haven't heard of it, but in the 1960s, well-known American journalist, called India's Most Dangerous Decade, which forecast that India would not stay together as a country. And that was not an uncommon forecast in the 1960s. I think there was a lot of India pessimism. And a lot of Indian nation-state triumphalists, of course, are quite happy that prediction was not in fact fulfilled. But whether or not it's something to be celebrated or not, and that's a normative question, which is not easy to answer. One of my fellow economists at Harvard, Alberto Alessina, once co-authored a paper called The Optimal Size and Number of Nations, if you can imagine. So I suppose one could ask a question about the optimal size and number of nations, but I think there's a number of normative issues that are very thick and very, very, very difficult to deal with here. So I don't view this necessarily as something that should be approached in the first instance with a view to evaluative judgment, but I think it is a remarkable empirical fact that India has had the relative success as a nation state, which it has had despite its extraordinary internal complexity and the many reasons that there might have been ex ante not to anticipate that, which I think is something which is not not entirely easy for us to see today. But this having been said, this example immediately raises the various kinds of questions which do arise in debates about India. For instance, how relevant is the nation-state perspective and the perspective of political institutions and of administrative institutions and their functioning, as opposed to the perspective of daily life and the perspective of everyday experiences of ordinary people? How relevant is the view from the center, from Delhi, as opposed to the view from the various peripheries which exist in India, and indeed from India's neighbors? So there are, I think, many respects in which this example and all the examples which we could provide can be viewed as the proverbial glass half full or half empty, which is one of the reasons that I have so much difficulty in coming to any kind of definitive views on the matter. There's no dearth of celebrationists, of course, as there are not. There is not with respect to any contemporary nation state. But I think it's good to keep in mind that in fact there is this duality. It's not difficult to view the problems that we could concern ourselves with, whether political, economic, social, or cultural, in either of these perspectives. The enormous historical achievement which India represents as a example of successful decolonization is, I think, also very important to keep in mind. At a lunch we had to prepare for this, we had a chat about Perry Anderson's recent pieces in the London Review of Books. And one of the things which strikes me as often missing in the perspectives which we have on countries like India is that of the longue durée, in which we understand that decolonization in the 20th century was an enormously important achievement for human rights and for democracy. And that it was a non-trivial achievement which took collective effort, not only to initiate, but to cement. And I think the project of Indian nation building, for good and for ill, has very much centered on that, on that subjective self-awareness. Now, whether and to what extent India has in fact successfully decolonized itself is one of the interesting questions which one has to address in thinking about the detailed questions which should concern us. For instance, in thinking about how centralized the Indian state is and what implications that has with respect to the reality or non-reality of local democracy is something which I think one can't discuss intelligently without thinking about the particular legacies which were generated by the British colonial administrative apparatus, the so-called steel frame of India, which as it was then celebrated prior to Indian independence. And in many ways, you can see the continued efficacy of that steel frame, especially with respect to the things that the Indian state really cares about and puts its mind to, including stamping out secessionist movements and engaging in ensuring its security concerns are furthered. In other ways, the steel frame doesn't seem to work very well. It can deliver, it has successfully delivered certain kinds of economic and social goods. Most recently, something like the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme is an example of something of tremendous scale and complexity, which has been rolled out across an enormous country precisely because of the continued efficacy of that steel frame. And whether or not and to what extent it actually functions on the ground is a subject of real debate, live debate, and there are lots and lots of details to be brought to bear on either side. But I think, without entering into a celebrationist mode myself, I think it's worthy of contemplation that there is a certain kind of administrative efficacy there. And if anything, I think one of the criticisms that one might want to make of Indian democracy and the Indian polity is that it has become more and more centralized. And there are many dimensions of this, including the fiscal, that fiscal revenues are generated at the center and dispensed more and more. It was always the case that there was that aspect, but it's become more and more so. And by and large, local governments have become executing agencies, insofar as they exist at all. Many cities, it will interest many of you to know, and this is, again, one of the many, many angles one could take on the Indian question, really have no living local government. They don't have democratically elected local governments, and certainly not ones with sufficient authority over the kinds of issues which are of increasing relevance in urban centers that function adequately. And similarly with rural democracy, democratic institutions such as panchayats, once celebrated, once thought of as the heart of Indian rural life and rural democracy, potentially, which have become by and large executing agencies of these kinds of national programs, and in certain ways, I think one could argue have been vitiated. And this contrasts, of course, very very severely with Gandhi's vision for Indian rural life as certainly consisting of vibrant local democracy. And indeed, in the 1950s, India was a center of so-called community development programs, which aimed to, in part with the under the auspices of American foundations and organizations which supported them, which aimed to bring about vital rural democracy. We see very little of that today. And the community development programs are, again, parenthetically, only one instance of the many examples of India serving really at the center of global debates on development, global themes, perhaps one might even say a little bit more critically, fads and fashions in development. And India hasn't taken up all of those fads and fashions, but it has taken up some of them. And to put it, to be fair, has also done, you know, pioneering work in developing and giving content to some of those, for instance, integrated rural development in the 1970s. And that's something I hope to get back to in the discussion. Fazia, please let me know when I'm running out of time. I may be, or Bipasha.
Bipasha's been
right, I think, 2 more minutes.
2 more minutes, okay. Thanks. So there are lots of things to say about the development experience. Since I have only, and about India's role in global development debates and the relevance of some of India's mistakes as well as successes in understanding those global development debates, both in their political and economic aspects. But since I have only 2 minutes, let me say something very briefly about the recent path of India's development, in particular after the reorientation of India's political economy, beginning in, depending on how you chronologize it, beginning in the mid-1980s or early 1990s. Toward a more market-oriented and private property-centered political economy. I think that the dominant or most important statement from the point of view of those who have social concerns about this, the pathway of development which has been embarked upon since then, is that while it has been very fecund in some sense in generating aggregate prosperity, leading to buoyant fiscal revenues of the government of India, which it's spending in various ways, on military expenditures, on National Rural Employment Guarantee Program, this and that, aid programs overseas, various or abroad, various such endeavors. It is nevertheless not a pathway which is reaching the mass of the Indian people. And the dominant Indian experience, unlike the Chinese experience, I think one would have to say, is that there are islands of prosperity which have emerged. And those islands of prosperity are in many ways remarkable. They're highly integrated with the world economy. They are brokered, or the economic relations which have given rise to them are brokered by very globalized people and economic activities. But they are not integrated with their hinterlands. And the pattern of growth and development which has taken place has not been employment generating and not been income generating in the way that one, and livelihood supporting in the way that one would have liked to have seen, and indeed is necessary for India in order to reduce poverty and more generally bring about, to use a phrase which the government of India itself uses now, inclusive growth and development. And this contrasts very sharply with the Chinese case, where Chinese development, even though it has also been inequality increasing, both countries have experienced very sharp increases in relative inequality and very great increases in prosperity at the top end. China has been very different from India in that it's had a pattern of development which has been labor absorbing and accordingly poverty reducing, and unambiguously so. But India has not, for a variety of reasons, including the failure to engage in supporting public investments which would enable that to be possible, established the kinds of dynamism in the rural areas and more generally in the peripheries of these particular islands which I referred to enable that to happen. And that is something which I think has many serious portents for the future. So let me stop there and we can have a more full-fledged discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sanjay. I think you must have definitely incited a lot of questions from the group. We turn the mic over to Siddharth Deb for your comments.
Thank you, Fauzia, for inviting me to this. Thank you, Lenny, Bepasha, to all of you for being here. I think, Sanjay, you just gave us this sort of amazing overview, very nuanced, very complex, very generous in the best sense of the word, and it's great that you went first. Because I am actually going to, you know, I think as a counterpoint, present maybe a slightly more angular, a kind of sharper insight, though you will find overlaps between some of the things, the questions we raise. I'm also, because I don't have Sanjay's confidence with facts and figures, I'm not an expert of any kind, I am actually going to read out my presentation rather than speak. You know, I think when I was asked to give this talk, I was told very wisely to stay away from being narrativistic by Lenny, which is a very good advice. And I will do my best, although I will inevitably lapse into narrativism on a couple of occasions, and including at the very beginning. So I wanted to start with a quote about democracy, because I also saw our brief as in some sense to talk about the idea of democracy. This is India's big thing, that it is a democracy, not just it's a place of problems. And I wanted to begin with a quote about democracy, but it's not from a work of politics, not from any social science text, not even from what might be a work of nonfiction. But it's from a very perverse novel by the wonderful writer J.M. Coetzee. And the novel is called Diary of a Bad Year. And in it, the narrator, a man called Senor C, he writes, "If you take issue with democracy in times when everyone claims to be heart and soul a Democrat, you run the risk of losing touch with reality. To regain touch, you must at every moment remind yourself of what it is like to come face to face with the state, the democratic state or any other, in the person of the state official. Then ask yourself, who serves whom? Who is the servant? Who the master?" I find that, being a fiction writer primarily, a very interesting place to begin. The quote, I think, it problematizes the assumption increasingly held, increasingly said by mostly by elite groups around the world, that to be a democracy is to be inherently good, fair, and just. But as Signorsi reminds us, democracy is usually a democracy in and as a state, where the abstract ideas of citizenship, sovereignty, equal representation, they often come face to face with the hierarchies of power. So some of the incredible contradictions we see in India, and which is really our subject today, between the democratic aspirations of people and the functioning of the state, are not limited to just India. This is what I wanted to begin. I mean, we could ask this of all other places that call themselves democracies, including the United States. But just this quote also emphasizes that the contradictions in Indian democracy cannot be wished away either, as they often are, largely again by Indian elites and their counterparts in the West, by saying that it's a long-standing democracy in the region, or it is incredibly plural and diverse, or that it is different from its supposedly authoritarian neighbor China, or that it's different from its Islamist, supposedly failing state neighbor Pakistan. You can't, these are the ways some of the contradictions are sort of wished away, and we can't do that. So one of my understandings is that the particular features of Indian democracy have a lot to do with the way it came into being in the 20th century, and in this I am seconding some of the things that Sanjay has said. It came into being in under a kind of colonial experience, and some of the features were not unique to India, including the increasing desire of its urban professional classes to have greater representation, parliamentary representation, to greater say in the state and the market. These were the conditions under, you know, that these were the things that were moving it under British colonialism. But they were not particular to India, not unique to it. Nor, for that matter, the incredible upheaval that accompanied this transformation, genocide of nearly a million people, a migration of between 12 and 20 million people at the very beginning. But again, the scale might be sort of enormous, but the particulars were not unique to India or to the formation of modern nation states. So India's move towards democracy was marked heavily by its colonial experience and by a kind of anti-colonial thrust to that experience. So given this background, which incorporated not just the quest for national sovereignty, a kind of civilizational reinstatement in the world, there were also radical challenges over the oppressed status of various groups, labor, women, so-called lower castes, agrarian groups, ethnic minorities, tribes. These were all part of that sort of quest to become a modern nation state, a modern democracy. And the post-colonial Indian nation began at least with the intention of reversing the incredible excesses of colonialism. But by and large, the way it chose to do it was by wielding the very state that had often served as an instrument of coercion and repression. And I'm going to talk about maybe one aspect of that. So the democracy that followed decolonization might have been post-colonial in its intention, but the state was largely a continuation of the colonial entity. This was particularly the case when it came to questions of security or what was perceived as security. So in this manner, along with the categories of citizen, which was also accompanied by the category of refugee, actually, many of us who are of South Asian origins here can actually, you know, have a kind of personal connection to these questions. So along with citizen, which was accompanied with the category of the refugee, the Indian state soon after continued a third category called the evacuee, for instance. And so it would take the example of British institution of the custodian of enemy property, an institution during World War II, created during World War II, and India created something called the custodian of evacuee property. Or it would take a policing agency like the Crown Representatives Police, or CRP, which with a paint job and an act of parliament could be transformed into the Central Reserve Police Force, or the CRPF, now the largest central Indian police organization used as a battering ram and a holding force all over India. So much for history. But policing, you know, so central to colonialism, is really a good way to again take up Signorsi's question, who is the servant, who is the master? So let me rephrase by this by asking, who is afraid to walk into a police station in India? And I'll offer some generalizations which we can argue about. Well, women, children, poor, minorities, those considered to be lower castes, the non-literate, the semi-literate, indigenous people, those breaking some social taboo. Obviously, some of these categories overlap, and there are situations where there might be affiliations between people and police, or just individual acts of kindness, or solid, you know, that's always possible. But those are exceptional circumstances. If you're not looking at exceptional circumstances, is it, in what are the circumstances where people like this can enter a police station without being afraid, without being, you know, terrified? So, you know, indulge me as I show you an individual from that group. She's afraid. She's joined by another person and another and another. And then slowly it becomes a mob or a collective or a group, whatever you wish to, you know, call it. So we finally have a situation where, you know, the police station is surrounded by a mob, and the sheer majority sort of creates some sense of parity between, of, you know. But what happens when the police overcome their fear? Now, the police are afraid, but, you know, what happens when they overcome their fear, call for reinforcements, and then the mob is, like, caught between two lines? Why do the police not just open fire? So the question is, there are procedures for opening fire in the Indian administration. You know, beginning, there's a very laid down sort of a sequence of events, beginning with warnings and including the favorite of the old, somewhat cash-strapped Indian state, the thing called the Lathi Charge, because bullets, there was a time when bullets were rather expensive. Forgive the anecdotal, but I remember meeting a paramilitary soldier who complained bitterly about having to collect the empty cartridges in Kashmir because there had to be evidence that they'd actually fired the rounds and not just simply sold them off to somebody in the local market. But so there are procedures for firing. But what if the procedures are violated, you know, and the police just begin shooting? So then they would have to face a kind of internal inquiry, some kind of internal chain of command. But that shouldn't be that much of a problem. As you know, the Chilean writer Roberto Bolaño puts it, a Sandinista or Somochista, the police is always the police. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of government you're working for. But there are other checks and balances which we want to talk about, which come from A, civil society, B, the media, and C, parliamentary interests, which can take this shooting, were it to happen, and bring it to the courts, bring it to parliament, institute a sort of interpreted in constitutional terms, in terms of the rights guaranteed every citizen, and can discipline or punish the erring policeman. And this is where it gets complicated, this question of, you know, between this sort of overlap between democracy and policing and rights. So if by civil society we mean public opinion, not every member of the public has equal access or opportunity or ability to express himself or herself in the terms acceptable to the nation state. In a very deeply hierarchical society, which India is still, especially, it falls to the elite to do this, carry out this aspect of civil society, to start shouting if the police start shooting. But one of the things that has followed the deification of the marketplace in India since the mid-80s, early 90s, is that it has led to quite enormous material benefits for the Indian elites, the middle and upper classes. And not just in material terms, to a kind of perceived alliance with what is seen as winners of our kind of the world, the West, the United States. And given this reorientation, it's become far easier for an urban, middle class Indian to perceive himself as a kind of alternative ethnic Westerner, I will put it. Franz Fanon would have a harsher phrase for that. I will let it echo in the room. You know, there's not much reason to connect yourself with the majority. And then there's the media, which has continued this, you know, has continued, especially in the last 15 years, to sort of drive the wedge between the middle class and the majority. The media, which sort of, you know, describes those of the elite, the middle classes, which might actually feel some solidarity, there's a simple word to dismiss them. It's the word is jholawala in Delhi. And so the media, and then the media has this nexus with corporations and political parties. Corporations own newspapers. Corporations advertise in newspapers. Politicians own newspapers. And this is something that's an increasing, verifiable, empirical trend. Politicians, you know, own corporations. So why would the media bother if this were to happen? As for the politicians, they might at the local level because of the patronage relationship that Indian parties depend on. But that in it's a very thin line against more instrumental goals of keeping power and influence. And if this hypothetical case of ours takes place in a conflict zone, like, say, Chhattisgarh, or in Kashmir, or in parts of Northeast India, where there is the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which declares a state of emergency and supersedes the police with paramilitary forces, immune from prosecution in the civilian courts, then the situation changes even more dramatically. The numbers there are very, very small in terms of population. Their parliamentary representation is very, very small in terms of the number of people in the Indian parliament. And then here, not only is there no media and civil society, here impelled by differences of religion, ethnicity, caste, and identity, India is best a paternalistic and patronizing present, at worst a brute occupying force. And so if I had to produce an overview of the situation as an argument, I would argue that that's mixed origins of India, anti-colonial in some of its intentions, but operating through a colonial flame, has begun to cohere into a much more uniform, almost neo-colonial mode of operation. And, you know, this is borne out by some of the new acts, some of the new things that the government is trying to push forward, like the national identity scheme, the national biometric sort of database, where a government very reluctant to sort of enforce rights or to introduce something like a Right to Food Act is very eager to have this alliance with the and ask the billionaire software mogul Nilekani to take over the national identity project. So you might not have enough food, but in terms of policing, yes, everybody is a kind of citizen.
Thank you, Siddharth. I'm going to try to breathe after that, but very interesting. So as a moderator, I will take the privilege of asking the first question and try to be more provocative than our two speakers, if that's possible. And what we'd really like to do is that you will hear my voice less after that, and we will open it out for questions to all of you so you can directly engage with our panel, and hopefully we'll have a much richer conversation that way. So what I would really like to do is, sorry, Lenny, but go back to the narrative. You know, it seems to me that like the United States, where there are clearly two competing narratives at work, particularly right now, what I observe in India is also that we are in competing narratives. And I'll just start with something that came my way, just dropped in our lap, I think, last week. And just to give you an idea of what I mean, the kind of narrative that we hear. We were in a business meeting last week in a round table with a very senior Indian, I guess we can call him bureaucrat, discussing. He's been tasked to come up with reforms for India on what economic reforms, what regulatory reforms India needs, a huge task that he's been asked. And the room was full of predominantly Indian origin investors representing various hedge funds and private equity and VCs, et cetera. And then there was the SEDF, some of us from SEDF / OSF in the room. Everybody listened patiently, and then one particular investor started speaking and was extremely frustrated with the lack of reform in India. So frustrated that he turned to this gentleman and said, "I don't care what it takes. Why doesn't the Prime Minister call out the military to move the coal? We need the coal to move. Just call out the military." And that came as quite a surprise to me as a narrative of do what it takes to get business moving, call out the military. And to me, as India, the largest democracy in the world, calling out the military to move coal was a little bit alarming. Then I woke up this morning and looked at the New York Times, and I looked at India Inc., which is, you know, a place to go for all things India in the New York Times, and I saw a headline which said, "Can Walmart build a nation?" And I thought, this is about India, one of the greatest nations in my personal view, and Walmart and India and nation, and what is all that saying? So I'd like the two of you to go to the narratives that we're looking at. What are the competing narratives for India? And where is this conversation going?
Well, thank you, Fazia. Let me say before answering your question that it is really something I forgot to mention, should have, is that it's a real privilege to be here with Siddhartha, who brings his characteristic, I would say, moral sense, literary aplomb, as well as understanding of realities on the ground in India to bear, and that's a very valuable and necessary corrective to my more aerial view on these matters, and more than a corrective, I would say. But with respect to your question, indeed, those kinds of statements can be heard from businessmen around the world, especially those who are not educated to restrain themselves. But it is interesting to note that the government of India did not take his advice. And again, without being celebrating at all, I think that this is an instance of the fact that Indian democracy does have its pressures on various sides, however imperfect they are. So you don't see those kinds of extreme measures being undertaken, and not however much certain billionaires might demand it. This having been said, I agree with Atul Kohli in his thesis in a recent book that the center of India's political economy has shifted more and more toward business interests being highly influential over government, and in particular big business interests, which is a change from the earlier dispensation, which involved more of a congeries of interests of various kinds playing a role. And this was perhaps best expressed by Pranab Bardhan in his mid-1980s book, or early 1980s book, on India's political economy, which argued, along with a number of others who argued similarly at that time, that there were a few different interests who had to, none of which was powerful enough to establish control over the Indian state, but and which had to negotiate with one another. The bureaucracy as an interest group itself, the business houses, more indigenous, more outward-oriented and multinational, mid-sized and large, small traders organized in their confederations, rural landowners, middle and large landowners in particular, and so on and so forth. So workers, organized sector workers, who then formed in a small proportion of the labor force and remained small, but who had a certain voice in the political process. That complex arrangement has shifted more and more toward one in which the large business houses are the most influential behind the scenes. And you also see their voice being the most prominent one in international fora. And this is where I think organizations such as OSI and others can play a very valuable role in, to use your phrase, shifting the narrative. I think the narrative has been business driven. Last week or 2 weeks ago in The Economist, there was an article which was headlined "Reforms at Last." And prior to that, it had been complaining for a number of months about the lack of reforms in India. There are many people, I won't name names, but in prominent universities in New York and elsewhere, who argue along these lines that not only were the reforms long overdue, but absolutely necessary to maintain the growth momentum in India. They have an elaborate metaphor of the bicycle, that if one doesn't keep reforming, it's like not continuing to pedal, that one will fall off the bicycle. I'm not quite sure of the logic of the metaphor, but this is the governing metaphor. And they point to the fact that there was a growth slowdown in India quite recently. Employment generation also diminished as a result, though I think it's really the reduction in profit opportunities, which that also implied, which was a major concern, and so we had a shift, a change of the finance minister, and so on and so forth. Introduction of these reforms, now enabling Walmart and other large retail firms, to enter the Indian economy, which was a major shift, much opposed by certain political parties, the left, so-called left parties, but also others, but nevertheless, you had this decision being made, one of the few difficult decisions being made by the government. And why did it make this decision? Well, part of it is this allegiance to business houses. Another part of it, which I would like to mention at the risk of going on a little too long, by way of an India-China comparison, is that in China, the value of exports is generally greater than the value of imports. So China is always accumulating foreign receipts as a result in its central bank coffers, just through the trade balance. In India, it's the other way around. So the only way in which India can pay for its imports is to have inflows of investment. So maintaining investor confidence is absolutely crucial for that. And that's what causes all the organs of state, the business houses and so on, to combine in presenting a certain message about India, private investment-friendly message. India doesn't have to fit the dominant, China doesn't have to fit the dominant Western narrative as much. It has more breathing room because it can pay for its exports through its, pay for its imports through its exports. This is a bit of an economist's angle, but I think it's important. One doesn't have to be an expert on Charles Dickens to know the formula that expenditures greater than revenues make for unhappiness and expenditures less than revenues make for happiness.
Well, I mean, I think I'm still absorbing a lot of what Sanjay said, especially the distinction between India and China. But I mean, I think what that points out is how precarious, in some sense, that this Indian, since it depends so heavily on keeping foreign investors happy. And certainly what was on my mind was the sort of this invitation to retailers like Walmart and Tesco, which are already there as wholesalers. So there's a kind of symbolic value, really, to inviting them to do retail. And the Prime Minister is quoted as saying foreign investors, in not just in Western newspapers, but in Indian newspapers as well. And so there's this, it just, I think, shows how precarious, I think, this Indian growth is, which must keep, and I always find foreign investors a very strange, mysterious category, of keeping them happy. At the same time, I mean, there is a debate raging in India about something like, again, I think which Sanjay can speak with authority, about something like the Right to Food Act or nutrition. And, the below poverty line recommendations that the government makes, and I was reading a little bit about this, something like, the government recommends that, you should not be eating more than one banana every 6 days in order to qualify for below poverty line. I do wonder, I mean, which raises the question of how many bananas is Walmart going to sell and to whom, really?
Thank you. I understand that Brussels has to leave us sooner, so I will open the floor to Brussels first for any questions that they might have.
Hello, and thank you for the opportunity to pop in with the first questions. I think we have three questions here, so I'll be quick with my first one. I think the EU sees
Sorry, is it possible to raise the volume from your end? No?
Is that better?
No.
Speak loudly.
Okay, maybe I'll just shout. Okay, I'll try with one question and we'll see how it goes. In the EU, there's a paradox between India as a strategic partner and India as a competitor for influence, a competitor for economic influence and political influence around the globe. Can you hear me?
Barely, but we're getting there.
Okay. I'd be interested in the two speakers. Appraisal of how India sees the EU and whether this aspect of competition between the EU and India is something that really filters through in New Delhi, or whether this is something that is a Brussels problem.
I have a second question. I don't know if you can hear me, but it's mostly relating to the could you say the romanticization of India, which is sometimes depicted as, the largest democracy in the world, one which has got women as prime ministers, and there is this view of a country that, yes, imperfectly, but still moving towards substantive democratic progress. And at the same time, I was hit by the statement of the last speaker that a democracy is a democracy internally and in and out of the state, so also outside of India. And I was wondering how much this romanticized view is preventing India from being confronted with its limitations internationally.
final question. It relates to the question of democracy and democratic actors supporting others internationally. There's currently between the EU and India a trade agreement being discussed, and I know that on the Indian side there's been a refusal to countenance the inclusion of a human rights clause in the trade agreement. There's been a lot of pushback from India on this question, and I think from the EU side there's a lot of frustration and confusion about the fact that the world's largest democracy has a problem with this. I think the notionally it's an anti-colonialist measure. I just wondered if the speakers had your appraisal of that, because ultimately, as OSF, one of the potential areas of work with India would be on collaborating via its vibrant civil society and also diplomatically in the cause of democracy and human rights. Thanks.
Thanks. I think all these questions are quite related. But the echo is not.
Basically,
they can't hear us.
Okay. I think all these questions are closely related. I think as far as the question of how India sees the EU, how India sees human rights, how India sees its international role, there's no such thing, of course, as how India sees any of these things. There is the question of how the government of India and a few bureaucrats who happen to be currently influential in a given ministry, the Ministry of External Affairs, for example, view the matter. And oftentimes it's incredibly dependent on that. Now, India, of course, historically has had certain postures. But those postures have been changing, and sometimes in ways which are both not fully easy to understand, and to some extent conflict with the views of the Indian population. Let's take the issue of human rights. I think that indeed, in international fora, India has sometimes taken the position that human rights discourse is basically a form of human rights imperialism when it enters into international. Too heavily, as it, India perceives it, into international protocols of various kinds, and it resists it for that reason. But I don't think that the view of the Indian population is of that kind. I think that human rights discourse has been incredibly influential in India at every level, and I think that it's embraced in India by the general public and by civil society organizations and by social movements. And I think that there is something to explain here about the disjuncture between the discourse of the state apparatus, especially in certain kinds of contexts, and these broader views. I think, to take one example, which just occurs to me, it's just one example, I think the views of the Indian population on India's foreign policy in neighboring countries, for instance in Burma, are completely at odds with the government of India's foreign policy. And this is something Amartya Sen has pointed to, for instance. I think that the Indian people don't want to prioritize extraction of oil from Burma over support for democracy and human rights in Burma. I don't think that the Indian people want that at all. But I think that there has been an increasing emphasis on the former rather than on the latter. And India is caught in some ways in the same situation as China, that it has its economic interests, capitalist class view itself as having certain kinds of economic imperatives which shape its external relations, and then these interact with historical discourses and understandings, for example, concerning human rights. But some of it's opportunistic, some of it's shifting. In the Commonwealth, India has sometimes taken positions which are very much in favor of democracy, very much in the direction of censuring the protagonists of coup d'etat, for example, and other anti-democratic maneuvers. And at other times, and more recently, it's failed to do that. So I think that I think it's a somewhat fluid situation, actually, and it reflects the complexity of India. And I think that that's one of the ways in which an organization such as OSI might have a useful role to play, by bringing about a greater integration of values with the impulses which are expressed, especially in governmental policies nationally and internationally. And I think that in India there's still a lot of nostalgia for what was conceived of as an earlier kind of India, which had an ethical foreign policy, and I think, which is to say a foreign policy in which ethical concerns played a very central and explicit role, subjectively at any rate, whatever one thinks of the objective manifestations. There is therefore, I think, a lot of room still to draw on that in various ways.
Yeah, I think in India sometimes there's this gap between policy and official government rhetoric and what happens, which I think is often actually a good thing. I mean, something like India is not, for instance, a signatory, as I understand it, to the International Refugee Convention. And that is partly because India is very obsessed with its sort of state sovereignty issues. It's partly anti-colonial or partly also just simply in sort of national security state obsession. At the same time, it is worth pointing out that India actually lets in a huge number of refugees from all large numbers of the world, not just its neighbors. For instance, soon after, you know, in Iraq, post-Iraq war, a large number of, you know, Palestinians from Iraq would come to India and be there. And in that sense, it's quite open at the level of everyday practice. That still does not translate into rights, which I think is problematic. But it is worth noting that it is far more open in that sense than either any of the EU nations or the United States, actually, for that matter. When it comes to, it's much more humane at that everyday level in terms of letting in refugees. And Burma was certainly, in terms of, you know, letting in refugees from Burma, not technically, I think it was quite humane. I think in terms of perception of the EU, I think in India the elite opinion, which doesn't neatly map on with government opinion always. But I think elite opinion, one of the problems is really seeing the relationship, the special relationship with the United States, which is seen as being far more energetic, far more aggressive. And there is certainly, in the EU, the idea of the welfare state, I think, plays a big role. And Indian elites seem to have a problem with this. They would see that as a kind of drawback because it would open up questions of providing, again, things like, you know, food guarantees or something like the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme that, you know, Sanjay pointed out, comes in for great derision from Indian elites in the urban centers and the, you know, diaspora business class. Which sees America, and I think, I mean, I would say even not just any America, I would say a kind of a Tea Party, Mitt Romney America as a kind of model. And it doesn't necessarily translate down into influence at the everyday level, but in terms of discourse, which is again largely both television and print driven by English or the dominant Indian languages, is driven a lot by the elite. And I think, you know, Sanjay has been making these useful suggestions about what the OSI can do. I think the OSI can certainly do more there in terms of, you know, if it were to choose to engage in terms of allowing that, you know, the diversity of Indian opinion to filter through in some sense in opposition to these extremely narrow sort of views being sort of bandied around.
Thank you. Questions? Please identify yourself when you ask the question. Gentleman in the back.
Sanjay from the Public Health Program. This question is for Sanjay, but Siddharth, you're more than welcome to answer this as well. Sanjay, you mentioned China, and we've talked about narratives here. So one of the narratives you often hear in India is looking at China and saying, why are we so far behind? And so they look to the state of China, and they see the ability for the state to essentially control and dictate economic development in ways that you cannot do for the reasons you mentioned in terms of democracy and whatnot in India. And so my question is, you know, when we talk about civil liberties versus economic and social rights, is there merit to this argument that China is able to provide for their people better because they've been able to basically dictate the means of production and consumption in a way that the Indian government cannot. And, you know, this messiness we call democracy in India, I mean, is that impeding the ability of economic and social development to unfold in the way that you described in China?
Well, of course, as with many things, yes and no. I mean, the if you look at the question of why China has the enormous advantages it has in manufacturing, which is basically the backbone of Chinese employment generation and poverty reduction and growth, it has to do with a variety of factors, and labor cost is only one of them. So even though it's true that China for a long time had very low labor costs, it no longer has labor costs which are much lower than many other competing countries. Its labor costs are much higher than those of Bangladesh, for example. To take one sector in which they both compete, which is highly commoditized and depends on labor, garments, labor costs. Bangladesh was able to enter the game because of its low labor costs, but it still cannot adequately compete with well, it does compete, but it doesn't. It's still very much less attractive as an export platform than China in many ways, because China has a whole package which reduces unit costs. And some of that has to do with government activity and even repression. For example, it has excellent infrastructure, roads and ports. Those don't exist in India in part because, because, as you may know, there's a labyrinthine process which is involved in negotiating for land, and hence the debates associated with land and its appropriation for certain economic purposes in India, political debates, which are very live. And that has to do, in part, with the political process and democracy in India and the fact that there's incredible contestation from below, sideways, above. You know, there are people who are claimants for the existing property who suddenly appear. So there's enormous complexity. And that is political in nature. And in China, the land issue is largely sidestepped because of governmental fiat. So you have infrastructure. Then you have almost no strikes. There was an incredibly large wildcat strike today in a Foxconn factory in China, as you know. But that's unusual. Basically, you have no strikes. In Bangladesh, you have strikes all the time. You have the ports being clogged. You have power outages. You don't have the power outages in China. China uses coal, by and large, to produce its electricity, which is not a clean way of generating electricity, but it's a cheap way, and they have a lot of it. So you have a whole package which lowers the unit cost. To what extent is democracy or its absence involved there? I'd say relatively little. You know, there's a whole debate in political science on this, whether there are, as you know, whether there are any cases of high-growth democracies as opposed to high-growth authoritarian regimes. There are moderate-growth democracies, but are there high-growth democracies? My answer would be, I'll take 8% rather than 10% or 12% if the cost of that is having a democratic system, and even if it weren't. But if that's the way one has to put it, one can put it that way. So I don't believe, you know, India is has been one of the fastest growing countries in the world, unequal in many ways for the last 20 years, very unequal pathway of growth, deeply problematical for that reason. And it's been shaped by the unequal political economy. It's shaping an unequal political economy. It interacts with all the issues which Siddhartha mentioned. But it has been a fast-growing economy. The notion that India should go in the direction of less rather than more democracy to raise its growth rate is, I'm sure, something which is entertained in certain circles. We know it is, but it's not, to say the least, it is not an attractive notion.
No, not really. I mean, I think when in India, at least again, within certain circles, when they talk about China, it's exactly the authoritarianism part of it that they mention, not the social justice aspect of it, which would be, to my mind, the more redeeming feature of, you know, the Chinese experiment, not the authoritarian part of it, not the fact that the government can do anything it wishes and move people around, but the fact that, you know, if we look at certain, for instance, health data, where you know, both in data but also at just the visual level, the difference is very, very, very evident and very stark. And I think, you know, again, Sanjay knows much more about this, but in terms of, you know, child health care or women's health care, the situation is vastly different. And sometimes I do wonder about culturalist explanations of this. I mean, in the sense that India is, again, I think sort of continuing its sort of colonial, sort of deeply hierarchical sort of mode of operating, and that inequality seems to be almost a part of it. I mean, sometimes I suspect that the Indian elites want to keep people, the large numbers of people, malnourished and undernutrition, because for various reasons.
If I could just add something briefly to that, which should have entered my initial remark, and Siddhartha's very right to emphasize this. One of the big reasons for China's success is its excellent initial record, which is to say, at its opening to the world economy in the early 1980s, it had already established, through the system of barefoot doctors and so on and so forth, quite a good record in primary health care. Levels of longevity of life, which were much higher than countries at comparable levels of income. Similarly, universal or near-universal literacy. So it had basics in place which enabled the population, this is something, of course, Amartya Sen emphasizes a lot, enabled the population to take advantage of market opportunities and enabled the growth process and process of development to be then also more inclusive, at least to a degree. Poverty reducing, not inequality reducing, but poverty reducing. And it's there that India has failed tremendously, which is an incredible failure of Indian democracy. There are debates about how to interpret the numbers, but India has a higher rate of malnourishment of children than does sub-Saharan Africa. And it may have a larger number, it has a higher number of malnourished persons than does sub-Saharan Africa. And it also has, arguably, still a very high rate of poverty. Income poverty. You can look at various kinds of indicators to see this. So these are failures of the institutional structure. I don't think that they have to do with callousness as such, though there are complex ways in which everyday callousness operates in institutions. But I don't think it has to do with callousness or intentionality in government policy. I think it has to do with deep state failure in the apparatus of and the machinery of service delivery. India spends a lot of money on poverty reduction. It has an enormous budget. But a lot of it just disappears. We know that it disappears for a variety of reasons. Some of it disappears at the high level, some of it disappears at the low level, but the budget is not small. You know, aid is not only insignificant in India now, it's been insignificant for 40 years relative to the government budget, even though India has been the largest aid recipient in the world, if by aid we include loans from the World Bank and IMF, World Bank primarily, Asian Development Bank and so forth. So it's had a lot of money being poured into to anti-poverty programs, which is not working. And I think it's that failure which we need to understand and where some kind of engagement may be useful and also be relevant for other countries.
Yes. Hi, Marie Linzer from the Revenue Watch Institute. I was wondering whether you could say a word on corruption. We hear a lot in papers right now, corruption in the coal sector and how the new, the current coalition government is has been the most like corrupted government India ever has. I was just wondering if you could comment on that and if you say something.
Well, I mean, I think the anti-corruption conversation, I guess, was in some sense focused by these protests that were happening over the last couple of years in India, primarily in urban India, led by Anna Hazare, and certainly people talked about a new middle class emerging, very, very angry. There are constant examples of this, and the government, I think, often reacts very, very badly to these things. But corruption seems to focus primarily on two categories, and I think the anti-corruption Anna Hazare movement, which has since splintered, focused particularly on politicians and bureaucrats. Now, that's very fascinating because there is a whole other dimension, which is the corporate dimension in India, which plays, from big to small, which plays a part in the role in the corruption. And again, let me bring in a very specific instance in mind, something called the Radia tapes, which were leaked actually by a journalist friend of mine. They had access to these tapes from the Income Tax Department, which showed a very high-powered British Indian lobbyist called Neera Radia talking to various journalists about politicians and corporate interests. So there was this whole nexus again. So the anti-corruption conversation in India, the one that's leaves out parts of it, like the media, for instance. It leaves out corporations. It focuses entirely on politicians and bureaucrats. And to my mind, politicians, for all their problems, parliamentary, they do have some legitimacy because they are democracy. That is, if you talk about democracy, they do have some kind of connection, some kind of claim to legitimacy, which cannot be dismissed entirely. So the anti-corruption movement was centering on creating a kind of ombudsman figure who would have the right, who would have, again, policing powers. India is obsessed with policing powers. It is not like we don't have enough police. But so the idea was that this ombudsman, what was the name for it? Jan Lokpal Bill, right. So you would create this sort of figure who would be selected from, and this is a very middle class idea of virtue, from retired judges, or a Magsaysay Award winner, or Nobel laureates, could not include any member of parliament. And that's very, very stunning, actually, what it says about the way the middle class views its relationships with parliamentary democracy. Or to take an example of a cartoonist arrested recently, and again, I am all for free speech, but, and so I completely, you know, I abhor the fact that the government wanted to arrest this cartoonist for drawing these cartoons. But, you know, which shows, but the cartoons themselves show the, you know, the parliament as a toilet bowl. What I found very interesting is that it showed it as a kind of Western style commode, which in itself is a kind of mark of its elitism, I think. So the corruption argument gets constantly about the fact that the middle class has to deal with things like electricity not being delivered properly, or water. At the same time, there are deep contradictions. I mean, electricity and water are not charged market rates, that's my understanding, among middle to upper middle class societies or people like us. So it's a very particular kind of focus on corruption. Nobody ever talks about corruption in one of the largest aspects of the Indian state is, again, the security state. We are talking about a place that employs more than 1 million people just in terms of the army. There is a tremendous amount of corruption. I mean, I was a journalist. I grew up in the Northeast in these conflict areas. There's a tremendous siphoning off of government funds into military. That is one of the reasons for serving in these areas. But the military is sacrosanct. Nobody will talk about that. It is always the only legitimate part of the Indian state. So I think the anti-corruption argument is very, very skewed and very, very partial. In India right now.
Maybe I think Siddhartha said more or less what needs to be said, but let me just add one word, which is that I think the new economic dispensation has made the amounts which are potentially available to be appropriated, in particular in the central government, but also in state governments, quite large. Some of that has to do with land, which has become a key commodity. Some of it has to do with other kinds of resources. In the 1980s, I think military deals with foreign corporations were one major means of generating resources at the central government. And a lot of it goes into political campaigns, which are very expensive, despite the fact that the Electoral Commission in India has put in place very detailed, stringent restrictions on what can be expended. So you have, which is an interesting kind of development in itself as to how it's trying to assert itself as an independent body, as part of a separation of powers in the Indian constitutional polity, but and quite vigorously in certain ways, but also arguably ineffectually in certain ways. So you have tremendous necessity for generating large revenues, bribes and gains from corruption, private gains, and you also have much larger opportunities than before in much more variegated sectors. And so the sheer scale of the resources involved is mind-boggling, tens of billions of dollars in certain cases. And that's, I think, part of what's drawing the attention. But also, and maybe more importantly, and something to understand, it's not just at the top level, it's the everyday experience that in every single transaction from birth to death with government, there is corruption involved. And the sullying nature of that from the point of view of individual persons who may do it because they have to do it, but who also experience it in the ways that the Bolaño quotation was also evocative of, as a kind of power relationship, which they cannot refuse, is, I think, very crucial.
Thank you, Sanjay. I'm going to turn to DC and London to see if they have any questions.
Hi, this is Emily Martinez from the Rights Initiatives here in the DC office. I have a question that comes from a meeting I had a couple of years ago, I guess now, with a human rights lawyer in India who opined that about 50% of the Indian territory is in conflict. And I just wonder, I mean, A, to what extent you would even agree with that percentage, but also I'm surprised that as a governance challenge, we haven't really talked about the growing level of conflict in India and how you see that playing out as the government tries to address some of the needs of the public.
Is there a second question that we can take at this time, in interest of time?
Yes, this is Jerry Fowler. I was just interested in Sanjay's comment that there's this disjuncture between the government and the population regarding the role of human rights and democracy in foreign policy. And I'm wondering if you could just talk about the opportunities that may be available for civil society, for the organized public to influence foreign policy decision making by the government.
Okay, let's take the first question first and then issue of influence.
Sure. Well, in terms of the conflict, yes, I think that's a very, very, very vital aspect of it. I mean, I don't know what the proportions might be, but that's not, I think, you know, Fawzia's comment very early on about the person who wanted the military to move the coal, one could argue that that's already, in some sense, being already done in parts of India like Orissa and Chhattisgarh. And Chhattisgarh is very interesting because it's in the center of India. It is technically not under the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, but it's almost a no-go region for journalists or for activists. I mean, and I travel a lot, but I've been told that, you know, to go to Chhattisgarh just involves a lot of preparation, basically. And it is like it's worse than Kashmir in that sense, or certainly worse than Manipur. So, and Chhattisgarh, so where the, you know, the government is engaged in sort of anti-Naxalite, anti-ultra-left operations, there are certainly large parts of the northeast India where, you know, there are these, you know, it's very, very heavily under military powers. The same is true in Kashmir. And I think one of the arguments that is being made is, again, it comes back to the question of why, what are the problems? Because these people are different in some sense. In the Kashmir, you have people who are, you know, Muslims of, you know, and then, you know, in the Northeast, you have a mix of people. Some are Christians, some are actually Hindus, some are actually animists. In Central India, it's, you know, Adivasis, some of whom are Hindus, some of whom are not. But essentially, everybody who's included from this sort of upper middle urban India, and I would say a Hindu sort of, you know, caste-based society, that seems to be a part of it. And it's something that, again, I think that post-colonial India tried to deal with it in no small part because of, you know, of the influence of Ambedkar. But I think it's become more of a problem in this market changes, post-80s. And again, the anti-corruption movement, the anger against bureaucracy, often seems to be also a disguised anger against the fact that, you know, bureaucracy involves reservations for the lower caste, for the what they call the scheduled tribes. So yes, I think large parts of India are under conflict. India has a pretty big military budget, very small by American standards. But I think, you know, the last figure was something like $30 billion, which was, I think, maybe 2008, 2009. And that's very large. And there's tremendous opportunity, again, for siphoning off money. And in that sense, there's a financial logic to keeping parts of India under conflict, you know, not military budget, and then resource extraction. That is a very, very big part of it. Not in Kashmir, but certainly in Chhattisgarh or Orissa, resource extraction is a very big part of that equation.
If I could just briefly add to what Siddhartha said, which is, again, I think says much of what has to be said. I'll approach this a little bit as an economist. You know, in economics, there's some very simplistic, stylized models which have an incredible influence. And one of them is the stylized model in which the developing countries are imagined as places which are abundant in labor and scarce in capital, and the developed countries imagined the other way around. Well, if you slightly complicate that model and introduce what the classical political economists understood as land, which means not literally land on which you build things alone, but also natural resources, minerals, and so on, into your picture of international economic relations, then very quickly one could have a very different understanding. Nobody imagined that India would be a country which would show itself to have a comparative advantage in land, in the production of minerals for export so that they could enter into production processes in China or elsewhere. they imagined before this happened, the last 10 to 15 years, that India would be a place which would be a center of labor-intensive manufactures. That has not happened, but India has become a place in which mineral billionaires, billionaires who own mines and who extract minerals and sell them in the world, have become not uncommon. The areas which were referred to, where there's the Maoist insurgency, are very much bound up with that development and with the sense that this is a process which is not serving the interests of the people there, in particular tribals or Adivasis. Now, in addition, of course, you have the existing historical grievances and relations between state and society, which are in various ways problematic. But that 50% figure, I think, comes from a home ministry designation. So does it mean 50% exactly of the land area? I'm not sure. As far as what one can act, where the reach of the Indian state or the writ of the Indian state is limited, probably somewhat less than that. On the question about human rights and foreign policy, it's a very interesting issue. I don't have a pat answer, but let me say that part of the problem here is, in many things, is that the process of policy formulation in India happens behind closed doors. This is part of the colonial structure, colonial and neo-colonial. And there are small elites of civil servants who know each other, who become very, very influential, few people in think tanks, but even they arguably don't have much of a role. Unlike in the U.S. setting, I think the think tanks are actually much more epiphenomenal. Mm. It's really the administrators, not even the politicians, in some of these instances, who are involved, and very small in number. So how to reform the Indian administrative apparatus, what you were discussing the other day, in ways that make it more democratic, more open, is, I think, a crucial question for foreign policy and for other things. India has joined the G20, of course, become one of the key members. But who sits in the G20 meetings and who influences them? It's the finance ministry more than it is any other ministry. That's not uncommon. India in that way is similar to other countries. But it's not good for democracy. I think that insofar as the G20 is a central organ of global governance, it is very important that in India discussion should be opened up as to how India should assert its role in such fora, as they influence other developing countries with which it still has some sense of subjective identification, and as they influence global processes at large. You know, India has changed its position on climate change, for instance, at least a little bit, and become, I think, more cognizant of the role it has to play, constructive role it has to play in addressing climate change. And there are many other instances in which I think that could happen and could happen more.
London, any questions from London before we come back to New York? Okay. Ami, do you want to identify yourself?
My name is Ami Patel, and I'm with the Soros Economic Development Fund. I just wanted to further that last point about climate change. I'm not well-versed or don't know anything about India's position, but is it driven because they feel they need to improve environmental issues at home, or it would give them a better position in the global market, or they'll be viewed as being green or conscious, or do they see the economic value of cleaning things up at home?
Very quickly on that, I think it's an acceptance of the reality that not dealing with climate change in a constructive way means very possibly committing suicide oneself. I mean, the monsoons in India, for instance, have already begun to be affected, it seems. There's good reason to believe, by climate change. And you know, the monsoons are a very delicate thing. Nobody can predict them. The Indian Meteorological Office has been producing forecasts of monsoons for decades. They're all unsuccessful because it's too damn complicated. You know, you can bring supercomputers to bear, and nobody can do it. People do bring supercomputers to bear, foreign and Indian, and they can't predict, because the relationships are not understood and very complex. And climate change is very likely to affect that. So I think there is increasingly late, but a recognition that it's true that the developed countries used up the carbon budget, global carbon budget, unfairly and disproportionately. It's true. But At the same time, there's only so much of the carbon budget left, and we have to deal with it. And I think that India and China understand that now, increasingly. So their position is evolving, but it's just a matter of, you know, of self-interest at one level. But I think it's still, you know, it's very incoherent. I talked to a climate change expert in India recently who said to me, it's totally incoherent. You know, there's no coordination, and it's potentially tragic for that reason. But I think there is some kind of an evolution. Let me mention one other example of this, in which I think India has played a constructive role for its own self-interested reasons, but in that way has also, I think, been of benefit to other developing countries. Maybe, and this is a better example than climate change of that, where, because in climate change, India's interests and China's interests are counterposed with those of certain other developing countries. This is the example of agriculture in the WTO. India's position historically has been that because agriculture is a source of mass livelihoods as well as an output-producing sector, it has to have special treatment, and it cannot be subject to liberalization on the same terms as other sectors. And this position has been resisted by certain countries, for instance, Brazil and Argentina, which, although also developing countries, don't have a mass of the population which is dependent on agriculture, but do have large expanses of land and view themselves as having a comparative advantage in the production of agricultural commodities. But I think India's position is exactly on point with respect to sub-Saharan Africa. Most of the places where there are poor people in the world are of this kind, where agriculture is simultaneously a source of livelihood and mass livelihood in a sector of production. I think India's position is right on that as far as addressing the concerns of ordinary people. But I think it didn't come to that primarily because it was interested in vocalizing a position which it may not have come to that because it was interested in vocalizing a position which was a global good for countries with such people, but because of its own understanding of its own situation.
Let's take two questions together.
Yeah, I'm Mina Yarmanfam, I'm the International Advocacy Director. This is actually a question that sort of links into something that you said, Sanjay, a few comments back about governance and foreign policy. And I'm just wondering, because having watched in Afghanistan, and I know other colleagues also have been seeing this, India very much being a governance actor, or, you know, exporting governance models, at least to Afghanistan, but I presume to many other countries in the region. But taking a very, very technocratic model of what governance is, while at the same time at home wrestling with the sort of messy politics of governance. And I'm just wondering if that's a sort of wishful thinking model of how the Indian administration would like to see governance take place, or, you know, what is it, how do you see that as a tool for both foreign policy and for conceptualizing governance?
Hi, my name is Vinay. I work with the Public Health Program. If you may permit, just a small narrative in terms of my own life experience. I mean, I come from a small town from a state of Karnataka. And when my parents ask me what I do, and if I speak about, oh, I work on health and human rights, they don't understand me. Or when I was working in an organization which was working with tribal communities, and when we have to work with them to organize, to demand their rights, human rights is not something that has an equivalent word also in my language. I mean, it has to be invented. Rights, yes, but not human rights. Or to sort of organize those communities with whom we're working in, human rights would not cut sort of a lot of, you know, ice with them. It would be social justice frameworks or other justice frameworks. Or when we sort of engage with the policy making either at the district level or the state level, international human rights elements plays no role. They don't even have heard of those international elements. And I was also a physician, and you would expect physicians to know a little bit about human rights. I am fairly certain that 95% of my own classmates even now have not heard about human rights. So given this scenario, and when we are speaking of open society and when we speak of human rights in governance, what do you see the value of using the language of human rights in sort of scenarios where human rights is not inherently sort of understood concept in societies? And how do you see the past couple of years have played in the Indian political scenario to advance that language and at the same time co-opt that for our own struggles, if we have?
Yeah. I think there's a kind of internal language existing that was quite complex and adequate. I mean, just what's wrong with citizenship? What is wrong with the language that's already there constitutionally? I think the experiences you're talking about addressing bureaucrats or police officials and finding them unresponsive to the concept of human rights, of course, I mean, they would be unresponsive to the question of the idea that, you know, you're a citizen. I mean, just at the experiential level, you would think first, what is the power situation here before you get into a conversation? So, no, I don't think it's necessary. And as Sanjay pointed out, there is a slight suspicion because the phrase human rights is often bandied around in the human rights, did I hear human rights imperialism? I mean, I don't think that's completely an unjustified suspicion at times. So I think the language is already sufficiently complex of democracy, social justice, rights, citizenship. It's really a question of using what is already there. And not just at the level of the constitution, but also what is organic to these communities is very, very important. It can't be just a top-down model, what Ashish Nandi calls a transfer of technology model for everything, including concepts. I mean, communities are pretty sophisticated in terms of dealing with these questions of rights. So I see, in fact, I think maybe some of it should be the other way around. We should be learning a little bit more from them. And climate change, for instance, is something where the Indian population, rural, semi-urban, was far in advance of every other, the elite sectors of society. The government has caught up a little bit. The opinion makers, the consumers are still not there, quite there. But if you talked about climate change at the provincial level in India, there wasn't really any question about this, about what's happening with, you know, in terms of land or rivers. Partly because the impact is immediate and dramatic. And so I think it's a question of taking communities. And the other thing is communities often transcend borders. This is the other interesting thing. The whole nation-state question comes in. And again, I'm thinking a lot about climate change. I mean, it came up a bit late, but I think that's one of the most important things that's for India to address. And in some sense, it has to be addressed across borders. Again, I'm thinking of incidents like in Bangladesh, the conflicts between Boros or, you know, Muslim communities. A lot of this is about land, about resources, and which is being, you know, provoked further by these climate change questions. So in strategic reasons, it might be fine to make Bangladesh dry, but it is going to impact not you as well. So again, I think there's a question of operating from the ground rather than from the top down.
I think that Siddhartha is absolutely right that there are probably multiple languages, Vinay, which need to be drawn on in any project of transformation and empowerment of people. To be very frank, there are certain actors who've also found arbitrage opportunities in mobilizing international human rights discourse, and it's not always clear they're the most progressive actors. So I very much endorse what Siddhartha had to say. I think in many respects, the question is how to make the Indian constitution more living and vital, and indeed how to make idea of common citizenship real. One note on the UID, the Universal ID Project, which is an extraordinarily complicated project. One of my colleagues is married to a senior researcher at IBM who explained to me that the government of India has approached him or his team with a query about how to do a very complicated exercise, which is the following. If given biometric information, how to identify the person whom that biometric information belongs to in the UID. Now, that is, of course, primarily driven by security concerns or notions. It's a very non-trivial computational project, especially to do it in a short period of time when you have a billion persons' biometric information in the database. But the UID, because it's driven by those concerns in part, is not restricted to citizens. In fact, the Home Ministry in India has a separate and parallel project which is meant to be a registry of citizens. There are millions of Nepalis, for example, who have the right freely to move in and out of India and to live in India, to work in India, by the understanding which exists between India and Nepal, those people will all in principle appear in the UID, but not in the Registry of Citizens. So there are these multiple overlapping ideas which have to be kind of worked out. Their roles have to be worked out. There are a couple of books, recent books, which have come out on how the Indian citizenship regime has changed to move away slowly, glacially, but definitively from citizenship by birth to citizenship by descent. And this has been largely driven by BJP governments because of their concern or paranoia about migrants, in particular Muslim migrants from Bangladesh, who they want to exclude. So you have very much, I think, a contested terrain. So on the question of Afghanistan, I don't know enough about the details of what India is doing in Afghanistan, except that it is a big endeavor in absolute terms and in relative terms. Also, of course, the Indians like to think, as the Chinese like to think in their interactions overseas, that they're better than the Western donors and interveners in various ways, because they understand the cultural situation. This is the self-representation. Understand the cultural situation, non-interfering, willing to get out onto the ground in the way that Western donors aren't, without lots of cladding and protections, enjoy trust as a result. Now, I cannot speak to whether or not that's true and in what ways that's true, but that's their discourse. Is it technocratic or democratic? One would hope that there would be some aspect of learning from the successes and failures of Indian democracy insofar as it's relevant, and I have heard of study tours by Afghan officials and so forth, but I who knows? I don't know, I should say, more than that.
Question back there, and then there's a question there. So we'll take your question, Thomas, and then we'll go across the table.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Thomas Heck from SCDF, and this is might be a little bit of an unreasonable question because open-ended, but I'll ask it nonetheless. Considering the lack of economic reforms and the growing fiscal and trade deficit, how can the current government and business elite increase investor confidence, you believe? And I actually have a second question, if you can answer it as well, it would be very nice. How are improving business and trade relations with Islamabad likely to affect domestic, political, and economic realities in India? Thank you.
Totally I didn't plant that.
That.
I, didn't
totally
I swear to God, I didn't plant that.
And your question?
Go ahead. Did in... hearing your kind of views on, you know, India announcing its ambitious plans to roll out universal healthcare coverage and, you know, healthcare reform, including providing free access to medicines, and you think this is too ambitious? It's gonna, you know, what is the kind of the political impetus for doing that as well?
I actually don't have any expertise on any of these. I haven't, so I think I'll let...
That doesn't mean you can't riff upon them.
No, I'll quickly pass the buck to Sanjay, actually.
I can help you with this.
Very good. You know, just very briefly on the question from Thomas. I don't know that it's the right question. How can India improve investor confidence? India has to because of the position it's put itself in. But that's the position it's put itself in. What could India have done differently, or should it have done differently? Should it now do differently? I think that it should have a program of development which is much more centered on developing robust domestic demand, and in particular, and very importantly, that is linked to the problem of income distribution and the problem of the islands and the untouched peripheries. If India were to have a development path which raised incomes and consumption for a larger mass of people, that could in turn be, to a considerable extent, the fuel for a process of domestic manufacturing, which would in turn be labor-absorbing and justify that. So I think that there is a different pathway of development which India could pursue, which is not exclusive of having these internationally integrated, globalized, highly competitive sectors. But it's something which I think India has not invested in enough in various ways. And just to underline that, One of the things that's happened in the last 20 years has been a neglect of vital public investments which play a role in enabling villages and small towns to participate in the process of growth and development. So for instance, the amount of money which has been spent on rural infrastructure, rural roads, rural credit, agricultural training and visitation services, and so on and so forth, the things which are unglamorous but all important in the process of development in a society has been shrinking. So, whereas, and all the emphasis is on the glamorous infrastructure, which is largely urban. So I think that there has to be a renewal of that public mission. That's those kinds of infrastructure, rural roads, for instance, are not appealing to private investors. There's no way you can have a build, operate, transfer model for rural roads, though you can for, you know, a bridge or a port in Bombay. So I think that that there is a public role there, even in a market-oriented model of development, which has to be renewed. And I mean, to some extent, there's been in certain electoral campaigns, there's been an emphasis on this. The India Shining campaign by a recent Indian government was rebuked by the electorate very decisively because the electorate didn't feel that their India was shining. So you do have, and there's been some readjustment toward the rural sector as a result, but I think still not enough, and it doesn't have a productive orientation. On the question of India-Pakistan relations, once I went, when just purely out of self-indulgence, to the India Office Library in London, and I read some files related to the economic situation immediately after the transfer of power in 1947. And one of the things that's very interesting is, of course, that Britain was very, very concerned about its foreign exchange situation. It had depended on India and Pakistan, other colonies, to produce foreign exchange for it. In the case of India, it was through the production of jute and export of jute and other agricultural commodities in large measure. Meanwhile, these newly independent states wanted to, of course, draw down their resources, their foreign exchange, in the Bank of England, and so there was a bit of a tussle between England and the ex-colonies about this. Now, Pakistan had no idea about its foreign exchange requirements. This came out in a number of the memos because nobody knew. They knew that the jute industry, a lot of the jute was produced in Bangladesh, but it was all processed in Calcutta. And in the West, it wasn't at all clear what were the sectors which would produce foreign exchange in the near term. So the British felt that Pakistan's demands from it were excessive. But of course they would feel that because they wanted to minimize whatever demands were made. Anyway, this is a long detour by way of saying that that the rupture which happened in 1947 and then more significantly in 1965 really disfigured the economic landscape. So what international trade economists call a gravity model of trade would emphasize that your natural trading partners are those who are beside you. Distance is one of the crucial determinants of trade. But if you close down trade entirely, as has happened basically, certainly since 1965, then you have a situation where there's a lot of potential advantage which is not being realized, and quite apart from the human cost, which of course has been tremendous and is tremendous on an ongoing basis. So I think that the moves which have been made to lower economic barriers are very, very crucial from this standpoint. Maybe more important for Pakistan than for India, but important for both. And they will, among other things, I think, help, if successful, and maybe this is one of the reasons for resistance in Pakistan, in part, but it may help to also change the nature of the political economy in both countries so that there's less interest in maintaining conflict to shore up certain constituencies, since there will be other constituencies which will be very much benefiting from live interaction. There was a formula which was put forward some time ago, which I think is not entirely without merit, about India-Pakistan relations, which is that, and in particular about Kashmir, which is that although the border may not be possible to abolish, it can be made irrelevant. And I think it should be made irrelevant at the human level, at the economic level, and that is what one should seek.
Yeah, I think in terms of India-Pakistan, I think there is this sort of very much this interest in certain parts of India and in Pakistan to have more trade. And at certain level, there is a kind of trade happening, partly because of actually, sort of, you know, again, the convenience of proximity. And there's a kind of ideology behind this, which is, you know, some part of it is good, which is like a kind of nostalgia on parts of, you know, certain people in both countries to have closer connections. And we are talking about elites, but, you know, there's this desire. And there is this idea that trade is good, globalization is good, open borders are good, and all that. But you have to remember there is also a very powerful set of conflicting interests and ideology on both sides, which is to maintain the military matters. You have to remember that military defense is also business. Defense is also money. Defense is also trade. For instance, the arms dealer I interviewed in Delhi some years ago, and he was an Indian, actually, but you know, he was flying off to Bangladesh, and he was working for an American company, and he said, I sell to everybody, it's business. And so it's this astonishing, and sometimes these questions come up, as in the decision of the Indian government not to buy US-made fighter aircraft, primarily because it was concerned that Pakistan is using them, so therefore they wanted a different system. So defense is business, and defense has a big ideology behind it. Questions of identity of India and Pakistan and the nation of states and their, you know, Hindu majority and Muslim majority identities are very closely connected and are equally powerful to the opposing idea of open borders and globalization and trade. I think one of the things that has happened, though, is that India, I think there's some consciousness that India has lost some level of moral supremacy that it might have had as a kind of non-aligned movement leader in the region at large. And I think this has now begun to sink in, that India as a state is not just unpopular with its counterparts in Pakistan, but also Bangladesh, also Sri Lanka, even Nepal. And I think that is partly shaping this sort of slightly, I would say, a better response to Pakistan, that India is now perceived as a sort of, you know, unpleasant, towering, powerful, but an unpleasant presence in the region across religion and across, you know, different nation states. And I think that's a good thing that this is beginning to sink in, at least at the governmental level.
Thank you. Sorry, one word on healthcare. We didn't answer that. I think it's very interesting what you say. There is a move in India, as there is in China, for a kind of universal healthcare, but interestingly, it's very focused on curative care. And that reflects the economic interests behind it. This is basically a reimbursement model for private hospital care that is being propounded, and therefore it's something that business likes. So this might not really address the more basic issue, which is the complete failure of preventative and primary healthcare in India, which goes back to state failure of different kinds. Then there may be some role for the private sector in addressing that, but I think one has to be extremely careful about it.
We have one last question, and it's back there. Please identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Kartik Srivatsa from Aspada Advisors. Sanjay, you mentioned that it's not the lack of welfare measures or the money or the aid for that, but the failure of the state machinery and the mechanism in kind of implementing this. Given, assuming that there is a certain behavioral aspect of the populace, there is the political and cultural characteristics of the country, do you see a model that's rapidly or massively scalable that India should have embraced? So we know that there's lots of problems because of which the state machinery didn't work, but is there a silver bullet that you see that should have been deployed or can be deployed? And not about islands of creating that this welfare program is successful, but on a larger scale at a nation level, is there something from a philosophical perspective that seems like a solution here?
Okay. I think this is a very big question, but right to information is an example. The Right to Information Act in India, which is being widely used now, and it was pioneering initiative in the world, I would say, developing world certainly, is being used by many people around India to try to understand how the governmental machinery is working. And to enable it to work better. It's an example of a cross-cutting administrative initiative which empowers citizens vis-a-vis the state. Whatever you think of it, you might think that it's not as successful as it should be or as it could have been, or it's, you know, it could even at best, it could at most affect certain things. But nevertheless, it's an example of a cross-cutting initiative which really tries to address the failures of the Indian state at various levels, right? So that a person can apply for a right to information or make a right to information request at the panchayat office, at the local government, or at the central government level. And the problem seems to be that too much information is provided, not too little in a number of cases. So there is, I think there's a lot more room for institutional innovation. And there has been a lot of institutional innovation happening in India, but in some ways of the wrong kind. So for instance, if you look at government procurement, or if you look at models for financing infrastructure, enormous number of examples of innovation that the stodgy Indian state has decided because this is the priority of the private sector, both because it's a source of revenue for it and it's and it needs that infrastructure or perceives that it needs it to do that. But if you ask the question, what is the Indian state doing to decolonize itself in these everyday ways and to transform its relationship to the society and to enable ordinary people to be more empowered, it's doing much less. Right to information came in because of a specific initiative by certain people, which was influential. Again, a rather Delhi-centric process, but it did happen. So I think one should ask, how can we multiply the number of innovations? How can we accelerate the pace of innovations? India has often produced such innovations in the field of development, and the world has learned from them. You know, I'm often amused at how Jeff Sachs and others emphasize that the need to roll out, to take to scale certain certain development interventions which work. But they don't ask the question, where did those development interventions come from? They came from the crucible of innovation that was government in various parts of the world trying to deal with problems, everyday problems, oftentimes in India. One instance is school meals programs, but there are many such instances which didn't develop as a way to encourage all children to come to school. They developed, insofar as they were given any justification at all, as a nutritional support program. But really, they were part of a what is sometimes called a populist, I don't like that word, but a populist political appeal. But it turned out that they're very good at bringing children to school, and they've now been adopted across India and increasingly around the world. That and many, many other examples can be provided. So I think we need to learn about and bring about innovation.
Thank you very much, Sanjay and Siddharth. I just want to make just one closing remark to remind everybody how important it is, this series that the fellowship group is offering to us, because India is the largest democracy in the world, and I personally feel that as Indian democracy goes, so goes the region and so goes the world. So we have a lot to learn from India and celebrate, and a lot to be worried about because of the national security paradigm, tensions that have taken over the largest democracies in the world. And I want to end with a quote that really struck me, and this is a quote apparently that Nehru had said more than 60 years ago, and some of you will recognize it. "We have gambled on the international stage on Kashmir, and we cannot afford to lose. At the moment, we are there at the point of a bayonet. To improve, democracy and morality can wait." And this, I think, could be said by somebody in the United States, somebody in Israel, or any other democracy today. And that is why we need to keep interrogating these tensions. And definitely in India, which we would have so much to lose if Indian democracy was lost to the world in any way. But thank you very, very much for participating. And I hope you found this as enriching as I did. Thank you, Lenny. Thank you, Bhupasha.